The stakes of the upcoming presidential election are high for Ukrainians. Who leads the U.S. matters a lot.
What our American leaders think, what American leaders do, directly have impact on whether people in Ukraine will survive or not.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. On today's show, Ukrainians watch and wait. We also check in on Spain, where flooding from sudden downpours has been catastrophic.
Forecasts and warnings were issued. I don't think everybody on the ground received those warnings in time or understood what to do.
And an Australian filmmaker who kind of wants his animated stories to wreck you.
If you're not an emotional wreck by the end of one of my films, then I failed. I want you to be exhausted by the time you leave the cinema, but also uplifted.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Glad you're here with us this Wednesday. Out in the Pacific Ocean, there's a lush island called Bougainville. It's part of Papua New Guinea, but maybe not for long.
The people of Bougainville are determined to win independence. Part of the plan involves getting support from Washington. Bougainville's leaders are trying to entice the U.S. with promises of access to precious metals and land for a military base.
If things shake out the way the islanders hope, Bougainville will become the globe's newest country. That's where we start today with The World's Patrick Wynn, who traveled to the remote island and the first of his reports on a nation in the making.
An independent song, sung by women in grass skirts and men pounding bamboo drums. Ask almost anyone on this South Pacific island of 300,000 people, they'll say it's unstoppable.
We are more than 200% sure that Bougainville will be independent. We will be independent.
Joe Pius is the gray-bearded chief of the Motaha clan, the people of the hornbill. There's also the people of the eagle, the people of the sea. All Bougainvillians belong to a clan.
We have deep-rooted ties to our land. It's all holy, holy or spiritual. Without the land, you can't survive.
The primacy of, quote, clans and tribes and their spiritual connection to the land is written into a new Bougainville constitution, now being finalized as this green island races towards nationhood. The chief says every clan wants independence soon.
Who can argue that people have spoken?
Bougainville is about the size of Puerto Rico, and it technically belongs to Papua New Guinea, a country whose mainland sits hundreds of miles away across a sea. Bougainvillians aren't too happy about that. But this island's problems with outsiders go way back to the late 1700s. It was a French explorer, Louis-Antoine de Bougainville, who discovered the island and named it after himself. After that came a series of colonizers, Germany, Australia, the Japanese during World War II, until the U.S. fought them for the island and won.
Bougainville proved to be of priceless importance as our fighting forces struck closer and ever closer to the heart of the Japanese Empire.
After the U.S. went home, Australia took over the island again and realized it held one of the biggest mother lodes of copper and gold on Earth. Now, this is where the modern struggle for Bougainville's freedom really begins. It's a story of islanders taking on a Fortune 500 company with bows and arrows. But I don't want to skip ahead. Australia held the island into the 70s, way after colonizing was seen as archaic. It just couldn't walk away from those precious minerals. A British-Australian firm, Rio Tinto, then the biggest mining corporation on Earth, came to Bougainville and blasted through a sacred mountain, Panguna, turning it into a crater, as described by this company film.
The Panguna mine is presently 2 kilometers wide and 430 meters deep.
It was the biggest, most profitable copper mine ever. Overseeing the excavation were foreigners. Adam Grissib was one of them.
It was great. It was like living in a tropical paradise.
Bougainville was mostly thick jungle, but next to the mine, Rio Tinto carved out a little colony town with a swimming pool, squash courts, and a cinema showing Hollywood films. Foreigners had decent housing, too, though an internal film for new employees warned, lock your doors.
As in other developing nations, break and entering by vagrants in search of food and money is more prevalent than in an Australian community.
Adam Grissib says the company considered itself virtuous for giving Bougainvillians jobs in the mining pit.
I had no idea. The natives lost their native lands and stuff to the mine. I had no idea. And that was pretty shameful.
In 1975, Australia got with the times. It gave up its biggest colony, Papua New Guinea, but as a parting gift, it just tacked on Bougainville, even though the island's people are ethnically and culturally worlds apart. Even after Papua New Guinea became a country, Western shareholders still made their billions from the mine. As for the Bougainvillians, they still got a measly 2% of its profits.
And then the rebellion started. That was an absolute shock to me. I was absolutely floored by that.
In 1988, a local clan said, "This is our land. You owe us billions in compensation." When no money came, the locals blew down power lines with explosives, shutting down the mine. Papua New Guinea sent in police and troops, armed and trained by Australia, to get the mine back. And that started a full-on liberation movement for Bougainvillians to end foreign meddling and finally rule themselves.
We did not have any military-type weapons. We were just using bows and arrows.
Laurie Patrick's village overlooked the mining pit. He joined the rebellion early on, drawing on skills passed down by his ancestors for eons.
We had experience in using bows and arrows, hunting bears and hunting possums and all that.
Now they were hunting soldiers. The rebels called themselves the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. One rebel, a 22-year-old named Ishmael Toroama, really stood out for his biceps and his ingenuity.
I used a bit of bow, and then I realized that, this cannot take me through.
Every Bougainvillian knew that U.S. forces, in their rush to leave after World War II, left some weapons behind.
They dumped a lot of rifles, so we grabbed them and, utilized them, and then we modified them on our own version.
With those rusty American guns, the rebels ambushed Papua New Guinea's platoons, seizing their machine guns. Toroama took inspiration from an American icon whose movies played at the cinema.
Don't push it. Don't push it. I'll give you a war you won't believe.
The First Blood, Sylvester Stallone, the Rambo.
Toroama and others, wearing tank tops and bandanas, fancied themselves one-man armies, striking, then vanishing into the trees.
We'll do an ambush here. After half an hour, we'll be on different sides of Panguna Mine and all across. That's why the best way to describe the fight in Bougainville is Rambo.
That's footage of Toroama in action in The Coconut Revolution, a documentary filmed in the 90s. For much of that decade, Papua New Guinea, with Australian support, blockaded Bougainville. Any boat coming in and out with food or medicine, they'd shoot them on sight. Chief Joe Pius of the Hornbill Clan was a top rebel commander. He says their superpower was symbiosis with the natural world.
We were connected back to the land, and Mother Nature fed us during this time of need.
Bougainville's volcanic soil, the same soil rich in copper and gold, is incredibly fertile.
Food, basically, we were dependent on our cassava, sweet potato. That's all. And coconut, of course.
Coconuts weren't just for eating. Some Bougainville high school teachers, hiding in a rebel camp, figured out how to turn coconut oil into biodiesel to fuel trucks stolen from the mine. Former rebel Russell Narokas couldn't believe it when the trucks actually started up.
When we tried it, it did work. You can smell the real coconut smoke coming out of the vehicle, but you can only smell it.
The exhaust was invisible. Soon, rebels in trucks were crisscrossing the island. Chief Joe Pius says this was a holy war.
Everybody's saying that this is God's plan we are following. During the crisis, they were so close to God at that time. Praying over the rosary.
Yes, the rosary. Almost all Bougainvillians are Christian, mostly Catholic, thanks to early 20th century American missionaries. Their faith in a Christian God mingles freely with indigenous beliefs, says ex-rebel Laurie Patrick. For example, A branch falling from a tree was nature saying the enemy is ahead.
There were many occasions where nature spoke to us. We always found out that if we had gone that way, we would have got killed. But the nature stopped us.
Many did die, 15 to 20,000 people, in the South Pacific's bloodiest episode since World War II. In the year 2001, the Bougainville Revolutionary Army's commander was Ishmael Toroama. He says God was calling him to stop fighting.
I tried to seek guidance from a man that is high above, that runs the spiritual affairs. And the word that lingers in my mind was, this is it. You are now on your second phase.
Toroama met his adversaries, gripping arrows. Together, they snapped them in two and tossed them on the ground, a gesture of peace. The deal they reached was the island would get its own semi-autonomous government and its own president. But as for totally breaking away from Papua New Guinea, they'd sort that out later. Well, 5 years ago, later came knocking. With United Nations backing and a bit of funding from the U.S. and others, Bougainville voted on its future.
I was in the room when the referendum result was announced.
It was a hot, crowded auditorium, says Gordon Peake, then an advisor to Bougainville's government. An announcer said the votes for independence came in at 98%.
It was that kind of stunned silence. Then there was a lusty cheer. But the thing I remember most about it was the women in the room started singing.
Today, Ishmael Toroama, the brawny ex-rebel, is Bougainville's elected president. He's now 56, so no more tank tops. It's all starched white button-up shirts. President Toroama wants to break free as early as next year, no later than 2027. And at some point, Papua New Guinea's parliament is supposed to vote on whether it'll let Bougainville go. But Toroama tells me, we're leaving, no matter what.
Just have to let my people go.
No going back.
We have reached the point of no return.
Some fear he's moving too fast. Bougainville hardly has a functioning economy. Most people eat whatever they can grow, the power cuts out constantly, and the roads look like the surface of the moon. But Toroama says he's got a plan.
We have to bankroll Bougainville's economy. So Panguna? Panguna, yes.
The Panguna mine, the same mine his rebels shut down, still holds an estimated $100 billion worth of gold and copper, mostly copper. And Silicon Valley has a screaming demand for copper. It is essential for building AI supercomputers, electric vehicles, solar panels. Goldman Sachs says copper is the new oil.
If the U.S. government, you come and say, yes, Bougainville, we support your independence, I can say, well, Panguna mine is here. It's a give and take. So whatever you want to choose, it's up to you.
Toroama says, wake up Wall Street, wake up White House. This is the deal of a lifetime.
Come, help us to mature the Bougainville dream.
At present, he's struggling to get the attention of the U.S. State Department, which is fixated on Ukraine and Israel. Toroama says, okay, dally too long and Bougainville will instead turn to China. But I'll get to China's role in all this later. Right now, I'm off on a bone-rattling ride to the place where Toroama shed first blood, the sacred mountain of Panguna, still guarded by local clans who demand a say in who will get their buried treasure and who won't. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bougainville.
Control over copper is our focus in tomorrow's reporting from Bougainville as Patrick takes us to the mine to meet the people who stand watch over it.
Careful in case you fall down.
Okay.
Quite slippery.
That's tomorrow on The World. Hello, Marco Werman here. Democracy is at the top of our minds this month with a number of countries holding national and regional elections, including the United States. Here at The World, we believe strongly that human-centered journalism is at the heart of an informed public and a strong democracy. We see democracy and journalism as two sides of the same coin. And if you care about one, it is imperative to care about the other. Every day, our nonprofit newsroom goes beyond breaking news to share human insights from the people living the stories that make headlines. This personalized approach, reporting on the ground and prioritizing the voices of real people, does not come cheap. It takes time and energy to find those guests with those experiences and is only possible because of the support of listeners like you. So as we kick off our fall fundraiser, I'm asking for your support of this critical work. From now until the end of the year, we are striving to raise $67,000, and we need your help to get there. Please go to theworld.org/give or visit the link in our episode notes to give today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for believing in journalism that strengthens our democracy.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The flooding in the Valencia region in Spain right now is beyond intense. This is the wind and rain pounding one town where 13.5 inches of rain fell in just a few hours. At least 95 people have died. Hannah Cloak is a hydrologist at the University of Reading in the UK. She researches early warning systems for natural disasters.
We could see in advance that there was going to be some very heavy rain, and forecasts and warnings were issued. I don't think everybody on the ground received those warnings in time or understood what to do, because as you've seen, you know, lots of people died in this flood and there's been enormous destruction.
Right. From the news coverage online, it certainly doesn't look like a lot of people got the message about maybe needing to evacuate or take other measures. Do you know anything about what those warnings said or how effective they might have been?
There were some warnings out saying, you know, red alert for rainfall, but this was a flash flood. So that means it happened relatively quickly. And so it's very difficult to get that message out early enough because it's very difficult to forecast those types of rainfall. But certainly, I think there was some confusion about the flood warnings themselves and also the cell broadcasting network. So certainly there are things that need improving in the future to prepare for these types of floods again.
I want to ask you about those opportunities for improvement in just a second. But first, can you tell me more about the limitations around forecasting heavy downpours like this? You say that the forecasts come in kind of last minute. Is that right?
Yeah, these types of storms that develop, they happen very quickly. And our forecast models will tell us perhaps one day ahead, sometimes a bit further ahead, what's going to happen. But pinning down exactly when and where that rain is falling is really, really tricky indeed. So you can say for over a whole region, although there is a risk of very heavy downpours in this area, but saying it's going to happen exactly over Valencia, for example, is quite tricky.
Mm. So the warnings might not have been specific enough to be helpful to folks.
Yeah, it's really difficult to know what to do when that happens. You know, as a flood scientist, I know that I'm at risk. But if you're just going about your daily life, then it might just seem, you know, a little bit pointless, like you don't know what actions to take.
So as the climate warms, heavy downpours are becoming more frequent in most parts of the world, including in Europe. What needs to change about messaging or forecasting or preparedness to prevent these types of fatalities from increasing going forward?
We do have to do a lot better. We can see people dying in floods. You know, that's really not good enough because we can get some earlier information out about those upcoming floods. There's lots of things we need to do. Being able to communicate that risk to people on the ground, making sure they can imagine that those floods might actually happen to them, and then knowing what to do so people know that they can evacuate, they can prepare their homes, they can stop driving in the streets and get into trouble that way. All of those actions need to be very clear to people on the ground. But also we need to adapt our cities. We need to make sure that we have places where we can store the flood water and that people are not living in places that are really at risk. We have to reevaluate where people are.
Yeah, I understand that this intense rain and these flash floods were caused by what in Spanish is called gota fría, literally cold drop. What is that?
So, you know, that happens often at this time of year. We get these types of storms developing. You get the cold layer at high altitude, and then you get the winds picking up that warm moisture from the ocean in the Mediterranean. And that makes it very, very unstable, the air. And then you get these storms bubbling up that have got a lot of water in them that then rain down.
So these cold drops happen every year in Spain, but obviously don't cause the same type of impact that we're seeing right now. Just how unusual is this level of rainfall?
This is an enormous amount of rain. You know, this is very, very bad, a monstrous storm, some might say. But it has flooded in Valencia before. We have seen flash floods before. Some of those will be beyond people's memories. That's how floods work. We need to look way back into the past to understand our flood risk. But also we've got a changing climate on top of that. So certainly this flood will have had some of those fingerprints of climate change in it, making it even worse than it would have been.
Hannah Cloke is a hydrologist at the University of Reading in the UK. In India, the Wikipedia page for Asian News International is a lightning rod right now. It says that investigations into ANI allege that it has, quote, served as a mouthpiece for the incumbent government of India for decades. The news agency has sued Wikipedia for defamation in a case that could jeopardize how the online encyclopedia operates in India. Nikhil Pawa is watching closely. He's the head of Medianama, a leading publication on digital policy in India.
The court has so far threatened Wikipedia with being banned in India. They've issued a contempt notice briefly against Wikipedia's lawyer, saying that they have to identify the editors. You know, there was a separate page which had come up, which referenced information about the Wikipedia versus ANI court case. So they had that taken down as well, and that page is still down. And now Wikipedia and the court has agreed to shared to serve those editors with the defamation notice and identify them to the court inside a sealed cover and provide ANI with a copy of that information with the names of the Wikipedia editors redacted. And that's where the case stands right now.
I understand that when Wikipedia took down that page, suspending access to that page about the lawsuit, that was a very rare step for Wikipedia. It has also revealed the identities of its anonymous editors. These are big steps. Is Wikipedia's ability to operate in India in real jeopardy?
I think Wikipedia's ability to operate or be available in India isn't really in jeopardy right now because they've agreed to take these steps. But imagine if you're a Wikipedia editor, and look, many people don't like how they've been referenced on Wikipedia, even if those references might have citations. And so now the easiest thing for someone to do in order to identify who's edited their page and who's made certain edits is to simply file a defamation case. Because from what it appears is that the court didn't take into account whether there is defamation against Wikipedia because all of these articles had references. Instead, they have, prior to even proceeding with the case, sought to make Wikipedia identify the editors. What this also does is it creates a chilling effect for Wikipedia editors to put in information, especially related to political actors and certain controversies, because they fear being identified and then there being repercussions for them because political actors typically have a lot of power, especially in a country like India.
Has Prime Minister Narendra Modi or anyone else in the Indian government commented on the case?
The Indian government isn't speaking about this, and I don't think it will. It will probably allow this case to run its course, and it might use the outcome of this case to push certain regulations that, again, enable the identification of anonymous users. And I would say one significant aspect about this case is that the right to anonymous speech, especially one that doesn't infringe on anyone's rights, is under threat as well. And if we're forced to identify ourselves everywhere, I think that's a sad day for speech on the internet.
What questions do you have as you look ahead to how this all turns out?
I'm just wondering about whether the court has taken into consideration the broader implications that it has for free speech beyond just Wikipedia versus ANI. One problem I'd like to highlight from what I'm seeing in terms of some of the narratives that we're seeing in the Indian press is that it's almost being seen as a US company versus Indian law situation. And so there is a sense of nationalism that's coming into how some parts of the Indian media are reporting on this.
Nikhil Pawa is the founder and editor of Medianama in Delhi.
In communist East Germany in the 1970s and 80s, political prisoners were punished with forced labor.
If they refused, they had to face pretty hard results, like they had to stay in solitary confinement.
IKEA is one company that benefited and is trying to make amends. That story and more still to come on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Swedish company IKEA is known for its build-it-yourself furnishings. Lesser known is the retail giant's use of forced labor. This was in the 1970s and 80s in what was then East Germany. Well, IKEA's German branch now has a plan to contribute more than $6 million to support victims of that forced labor scheme, political prisoners whose punishment included forced labor for IKEA and several other companies. Peter Koip was himself such a political prisoner. He's now a historian with the Union of Victims Associations of Communist Tyranny and researches the use of forced labor in the former East German state.
For all the Western companies, East Germany at the time, it was called the cheap salary country, so to say. There were trade relations between the East and West Europe and East and West Germany. And the companies who West Germany had a contract with, they also had branches of their production in prisons. And because in the prison, the salary was even lower, so it was even more cheap. And for that reason, it was a good business for East Germany to let produce in prisons.
So we're talking private companies like IKEA and others. Was this scheme endorsed by European nations, by governments, and by the international community?
During the Cold War, it was basically up to the companies to take responsibility and to care about the production conditions among people in East Germany had to work for. It was up to the companies.
In the case of IKEA, though, were the factories in the prisons or were the inmates driven to work and then back to the prison?
No, the companies were in the prisons. So that means it was kind of an extraterritorial area, so to say. It was fenced up and guarded, but it was within the prison facility. I remember I was imprisoned in Cottbus. I worked for a company called Pentagon. This was a camera company. And we had to do forced labor. And we worked in three shifts. And when we started our shift, we left the prison building where our cell was located. We had to march in a row.
They took your clothes away.
Yeah, that's right. Under the eyes of guards. And into this exterritorial area. And there we had to work. There were bars in front of the windows as well. There were guards everywhere. But there we also met civilian employees from the companies.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like slave labor. So now IKEA's German branch is offering to pay $6.5 million to compensate victims in acknowledgement of this history. It is a voluntary compensation, as I gather. Nobody's making IKEA pay up. What is the significance of that decision from your view?
That a company shows responsibility, that a company officially takes responsibility. And this is remarkable because no company so far did this. Many other companies are requested, but they basically refuse talking to us. And IKEA is the first institution which does. And we think that puts pressure on the other companies.
The grocery store chain Aldi, which had also benefited from forced labor in the former East Germany, Aldi has not followed the IKEA lead and not made a voluntary payment to victims. What is the argument you'd make to Aldi to compensate victims of the scheme?
Aldi not yet did something, but yesterday I sent Aldi the IKEA decision, and today I got an answer from Aldi right away, and they haven't answered for a couple of months now, but they immediately answered and said, okay, we still can't see our own responsibility, but let us keep in touch.
Sounds like the door is not closed.
Yes, so that's what I assume, that's what I hope. Aldi at least keeps it kind of open, and this is something. And according to the email I got today, we are kind of hopeful.
Today, as you're probably well aware, there is a huge discussion around the use of forced labor in making products we buy. I'm thinking of cotton produced by Uyghur political prisoners in China, for example. IKEA has previously said it will not use cotton from Xinjiang, the territory in China where these prisoners allegedly are forced to produce this. As someone, though, who was forced to work because of your political views, do you see a connection?
Of course I see a connection. So this gets normal people in touch with this issue. So people maybe are more conscious buying products in department stores. So they probably look at the brand, if it's made in China or in other dictatorships or in countries where people have to work for these companies under really problematic conditions. So the IKEA example shows that companies who profit from this kind of forced labor, they can't just refuse responsibility. And I think this IKEA decision is the first huge step to get this issue in the heads of a huge amount of consumers.
Peter Kuip is a historian with the Union of Victims Associations of Communist Tyranny. He was one of the political prisoners from the former East Germany who was forced to work in a factory as punishment.
Americans are not the only ones obsessively tracking the latest polls in the U.S. presidential race. Ukrainians are watching each new piece of election news closely as well, because the outcome of our election could be a matter of life and death for them. Emily Johnson brings us the story from Kyiv.
I'm here at Maidan Square in central Kyiv, where the state violently cracked down on protesters during Ukraine's 2014 revolution. These days, it's full of faces. Pictures of those who've died in the war and a sea of fluttering flags. Mostly the blue and yellow of Ukraine, but a few stars and stripes can be found here as well, representing Americans who've fallen.
Вони звинувачують українську сторону нібито у прихильності до кандидатки у президенти США від демократичної.
A stone's throw away from the square, journalists are busy preparing a news radio program. Кирила Лукаренко, the executive director of Хромадське Radio, says their listeners are paying close attention to what's about to unfold in the United States.
Ukrainian audiences are thinking about the war. They view the U.S. elections in relation to what's going on the front line, and they are interested in U.S. support to the Ukrainian existential struggle. This is very, very direct connection.
The United States is the number one supplier of military aid to Ukraine. During September's presidential debate, Harris touted her record of support for Ukraine as part of the Biden administration, while Trump notably refused to say he hoped Ukraine would win the war. With Russia advancing along several key front lines and winter around the corner, there is a sense of urgency among Ukrainians that more must be done if they are going to win. Daria Kalinyuk, executive director at the Anti-Corruption Action Center.
It's not just myself, but every Ukrainian understands that we depend a lot on the support from our allies, first of all, Americans.
But she says they don't understand why that support has been so cautious. Out of concerns over escalation, Biden has so far refused to allow long-range strikes inside Russia.
What our American leaders think, what American leaders do, and first of all, what American citizens think and do, directly have impact on whether people in Ukraine will survive or not.
This is a common theme here, that this isn't just about Ukraine. Ukrainians see themselves as an increasingly precarious dam holding back a flood of authoritarianism from inundating the free world. Alexander Kraev of foreign policy think tank Ukrainian Prism.
And of course, through defeating Russia, you will also defeat China to an extent. You will deter China. China will be weaker. China will not attack Taiwan. China will not be aggressive in its economic politics. So you will kill two birds with one stone, basically.
It was recently confirmed that North Korea is sending troops to fight alongside Russia. And as Kyiv residents hunker down during air raids, it's Iranian drones in the skies above.
Then the consequences would be drastic, both for the United States and its allies in Europe.
Attention. As I sit in a basement shelter with Jan Earl Ruzhitsky, another alert goes off. Ruzhitsky is a student who recently spent 5 months in Washington, D.C. as part of his studies in international relations. He says he's paying close attention to the U.S. election, though he can't say for certain whether he'll stay up to watch the results live.
I'm not sure whether I would give up my sleep at night, because, you know, with air raid alerts, it's too important, too vital to sleep. But we will definitely be following that.
During his time in the U.S., he says, he was struck by how polarized the political dialogue has become, and he worries about the consequences of Ukraine being reduced to a talking point. For young Ukrainians contemplating their futures, the stakes are very real. At the Kyiv School of Economics, students chat and study in a ground-level cafe. The atmosphere feels very typical of a university, but one level down, classrooms have been set up in the basement, so learning can continue even during the frequent air raid alerts.
A lot of my relatives are now in the Ukrainian army, so I know what it is to worry about the life of your close brothers and relatives at all, and it's hard.
Marichka Poptanich is a second-year student here at KSE studying law. Mindful of the polarized discourse in the U.S., most Ukrainians are reluctant to state in blunt terms a preference for one candidate over the other, not wanting to be accused of meddling in U.S. affairs. But university students, who are exempt from the draft, are increasingly nervous.
A lot of boys say to me that if Trump wins, we would go all to army because we wouldn't be capable of standing without the help of America, without the ammunition, without the world leadership, and that might be the end for us.
Even if the current degree of support continues, those on the front lines wonder exactly what it's supposed to accomplish. Anastasia Stanko, a journalist who's reported from the front, remembers standing in a destroyed town that is now under Russian occupation.
And one artillery commander of one unit said, "You know, these Americans, they don't want us to win, and they don't want us to lose. They just want us to, like, not die somehow, and that's all. But it's impossible that we can fight, like, for 10 or 20 years just to stay on the such a big front line, you know?"
For The World, I'm Emily Johnson, Kyiv, Ukraine.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
New Zealand's capital, Wellington, will wave goodbye to a work of art that's both loved and loathed. The giant statue is a 16-foot hand with the artist's face smack dab in the middle. This creepy visual sits atop the roof of City Gallery and looks out over all of Wellington. It will be lifted away by helicopter this weekend and taken to an undisclosed location.
Another goodbye, Starbucks is getting rid of its olive oil-infused coffees. A new boss took over the coffee giant last week, and he promised to simplify what he called an overly complex menu. No outcry in the U.S. or Canada over the end of the Oleato line. I guess some things just weren't meant to be.
And France has a plan to tax foods with high sugar content. Doctors love the idea, as you might imagine. Business leaders, less so. The sugar tax is meant to help the French manage rising obesity.
And that's a few things you might have missed. Once upon a time, stop-motion animation sounded like this.
"Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?"
"It will be an honor, sir."
Earnest, kid-friendly, well, forget all of that. We're going to introduce you to an Australian animator whose latest film is about a lonely hoarder with a thing for snails. The World's Sarah Birnbaum caught up with the man behind the clay.
Adam Elliott remembers the day he fell in love with animation. He was in film school in 1996 in Animation 101, drawing on cells on acetate.
The first thing I ever did was a tear rolling down a clown's face. And my father was a clown, an acrobatic clown, so that was quite appropriate. And I remember that moment when I saw the animation play back and that tear rolled down the face. I thought, oh, wow, I'd created life. I felt like I was a god.
These days, Elliott is still playing God. His medium is stop-motion claymation, which by Elliott's own admission takes a very special kind of person. Claymation is one of the most laborious ways to make a film. You basically take a clay object and then take a picture of it, and then you change the object in some very small way, then you take a picture of it, then you change the object, take another picture, you change the object, and take a picture, then you tweak the object and take a picture, and you change it and take a picture and change it and take a picture and change it and take a picture.
It is a challenging, slow, expensive art form. It can be very soul-destroying.
As all the best things in life are. Elliott's new film, Memoir of a Snail, uses 7,000 objects, 200 sets, and 135,000 frames. It took 8 years to make. And the result is, by turns, grim, hilarious, odd, grotesque, and deeply moving.
You know, I always say if you're not an emotional wreck by the end of one of my films, then I failed. I want you to be exhausted by the time you leave the cinema, but also uplifted.
At the beginning of the film, the main character, Grace Puddle, tells the story of her life to her pet snail, Sylvia. And she begins with a line I want embroidered on a pillow.
"Dad used to say that childhood was like being drunk. Everyone remembers what you did, except you."
But Grace's childhood is quite vivid, and that's because it's full of trauma. Her mother dies in childbirth. Her dad is a paraplegic alcoholic with sleep apnea. Her father dies, and Gracie and her twin brother Gilbert go to different foster families. Grace gets adopted by a couple of dippy swingers, and Gilbert goes to religious fundamentalists in the outback. The heart of the movie is a character named Pinky, a vivacious octogenarian who Grace describes as her one true friend.
She drove her dead husband's postal truck and once told me she wanted to die peacefully in her sleep like her cousin who was a bus driver, not screaming in horror like his passengers. I'm not sure whether she was joking. It was hard to know with her.
Pinky has had quite a life. She was an exotic dancer in a schnitzel bar. She had sex with the singer John Denver in a helicopter and once played ping pong with Fidel Castro. How does Adam Elliott come up with this stuff? Elliott says he's kept a detailed notebook for decades where he collects descriptions, anecdotes.
Things I've observed, things I've read, things I've eavesdropped on public transport. They're just recipe books and ingredients for my films.
Elliott's always been interested in the outcasts and the misfits and the underdogs, people with some limitation or what society perceives as a limitation. In his film Harvey Crumpet, which won the Academy Award in 2004 for Best Animated Short, the main character, Harvey, is a Polish refugee with Tourette's. In Marion Max, Elliott's first full-length feature, Max is a morbidly obese middle-aged man with Asperger's syndrome. Elliott has a disability of his own.
My body shakes more than the average person. My mother had it, my grandfather had it, and it's called a physiological tremor.
His drawings are wobbly because of it.
So instead of fighting that and trying to control it, I thought, I'll stuff it. I'll just embrace it. I'll just celebrate the chunky wonkiness, and that can become my aesthetic, and I won't have to worry about ever drawing a straight line or a perfect circle.
He says the tough bit is getting other people to do it.
A few of the prop makers on this film, they would make a prop and I said, oh no, it's too good. It's too good. Can you drop it on the ground a few times?
The clay figures in his movies look a little battered. You can see the fingerprints and the clay and the cracks. But he says it works. We're all a little bit broken.
We all feel like we don't fit in at times. We all feel lonely and misunderstood at times. So it's just part of the human condition, and I'm just trying to reflect that in blobs of clay.
Blobs of clay with all their beautiful imperfections. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Memoir of a Snail is released nationwide next Friday. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Transportation workers in Peru are fed up. They've gone on strike to demand government protection from criminal groups that have been forcing bus drivers, small businesses, and street vendors to pay weekly protection fees or face violent attacks, even death. One of the protesters there saying, these criminals don't come out to threaten you, they come to kill you. The World's Tibisay Zeya reports on the controversial response from the Peruvian government.
President Dina Boluarte believes the root cause of rising crime in Peru is simple: unauthorized migration from Venezuela.
Muy buenas tardes, señoras y señores de la prensa.
Last week, in televised remarks, she announced a new immigration policy.
Les vamos a exigir a cada venezolano.
We are going to demand that every Venezuelan who supposedly works legally presents their work and rental contract to be able to obtain legal residence, she said. Also, the government will monitor all remittances from Venezuelans that are sent out of the country to find out where their income is coming from. Many Venezuelans living in Peru believe these measures are hostile and unfair. They point us all out equally, including honest workers, says Luz Marina, a Venezuelan migrant who sells coffee and empanadas in the streets of Lima. She says the new requirements will close doors for her to apply for legal residence. And it will not help reduce crime, she says. Close to 8 million Venezuelans have left their country over the past decade, fleeing poverty and repression. And more than 1.5 million have settled in Peru. According to police data, crimes committed by Venezuelans represent a tiny fraction compared to those committed by Peruvians. But a notorious gang from Venezuela called Tren de Aragua is now operating in several South American countries, including Peru.
Tren de Aragua es el enemigo número uno de Perú. Por supuesto, estamos hablando
News reports frequently highlight crimes committed by this gang, fueling negative perceptions of Venezuelans.
Ya la asociación entre extranjero y venezolano, que sea el que delinque, está hecha.
The link between Venezuelans and crime is already made in the minds of many in Peru, says Maoli Sanchez, a Venezuelan activist there. She says many times it's Venezuelans who are the main target of the Tren de Aragua gang. About 30% of Venezuelan migrants in Peru say they have suffered discrimination, mostly in public spaces, due to their nationality. That's according to a recent study. But not all Peruvians blame Venezuelan migration for the rising crime rate.
Hasta el momento, no hay solución por parte del legislativo sobre el pedido de la ley 32108.
Martín Valeriano, spokesman for the National Association of Transportation Workers in Peru, says Congress bears major responsibility. A new law that passed in August has reduced authorities' capacity to investigate crime. It bars prosecutors from investigating migrant trafficking, illegal logging, embezzlement, and 56 other offenses.
To me, it's a naked attempt by lawmakers to protect themselves. Many of them are under investigation for corruption and other offenses, but it's creating a much weaker rule of law in Peru.
Will Freeman is a political analyst with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says blaming Venezuelan migration for crime is just meant to deflect attentions from the Peruvian state's failings. Transportation workers are now calling on a national strike for mid-November. It's bad timing for President Boluarte, because it will be right when Peru will be hosting a summit of leaders from the Pacific region, including the presidents of China, Brazil, and President Biden. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea, Mexico City.
Game 5 of the World Series is tonight. Last night's Yankees victory dashed the Dodgers' hope for a sweep. In Japan, though, the safe money is still on Los Angeles, and that's in no small part thanks to star player Shohei Ohtani. Reporter Rebecca Rossman spent time with some of his fans in Tokyo to get a sense of peak Ohtani craziness.
The first thing you should know is that Japan's fever for Shohei Ohtani can be seen just about everywhere. The 30-year-old star hitter and pitcher's name and face are emblazoned on T-shirts, plush toys, rice. Yes, branded rice.
Yeah, we've been talking about the Ohtani effect, and we're seeing him on all the ads.
This is American Jesus Garcia Jr. He's on vacation in Tokyo and is one of about 100 people crowded inside this sports bar, which opened at 9 a.m. local time, so fans could watch Game 4 of the World Series live. Garcia Jr. is an outlier here, a Yankees fan in a sea of Dodgers jerseys. Most of them with Ohtani's name written on the back.
I'm mad that we didn't end up getting him for the Yankees, but he's a very talented player. He represents a lot and means a lot to everyone around here. Every time that he's up, you can see everyone's excitement, and it is exciting seeing him play.
Yeah, every TV, every Ohtani is here.
22-year-old student Shin Yoshino has been following Ohtani since the beloved athlete got his start in professional baseball over a decade ago, playing for Japan's Nippon Ham Fighters. Yoshino was only a kid then. He says he's looked up to Ohtani ever since.
In Japanese culture, we need to look up the adult people like that. And he have those kind of Japanese culture mind and American culture mind.
In other words, he says, Ohtani represents the best of both worlds. If he's already worshipped in the U.S. for his athletic skills, it's his temperament that fans here in Japan emphasize when they talk about Ohtani. This is 49-year-old Nami Kiyokawa.
He's very humble and he's kind, and, you know, he's all that, you know, he's a good person, and he's also a great player.
Ohtani has twice won the American League MVP award. As for the title of World Series champion, that's something Ohtani and the fans here may have to wait for just a little longer. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Tokyo.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can make it again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Carol Boschka, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, Janae Elzey, Kira and Peter McGrath. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.